Hi, I'm Dr. David Rubin from the University of Chicago, and I'm coming to you from the American College of Gastroenterology annual meeting in Orlando, Florida, which was from October 13th through October 18th, 2017. This year, it was a special meeting because it was done in conjunction with the World Congress of Gastroenterology. There were a record number of attendees here, an estimate of over 6,000 people who joined us, and this is best of the day from this great meeting. Joining me is Dr. Susie Kane from the Mayo Clinic. She's a professor of medicine there, but she's also a good friend and one of the board of trustees members for the American College of Gastroenterology. At this meeting, Dr. Kane ascended the ranks and became the president-elect of this great organization. Susie, thank you for joining
me. Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit about inflammatory bowel disease at this meeting and some of the key, but I couldn't help but want you to start by telling us about your named lectureship that you're giving at this meeting, the David Graham Lecture, a very distinguished lecture. Congratulations on that. But it's on the topic of leadership in medicine. So why don't we just start with that and you tell the viewers out there what this is going to be about.
Right. So it was a great honor to be asked. First of all, Carol Burke, the outgoing president, felt that the issues of leadership in medicine today are so important that we need role models, we need education, that this really needed to be brought to light. And so in my talk, I'm going to talk about what it takes to be a good leader, but also importantly, why we need good leadership right now and how do you get there? Because leaders in academic medicine and in big practices actually are promoted from within because of their attributes and their strengths in patient care, in research, but not in necessarily leadership skills. And where do you get those skills from? We focus on CME and medical education, but it's a completely different skill set to be able to be a good leader. So how do you get there? And the timing of that through your career, when should that be? Does it start right out of fellowship? Is it mid-career? Is it late career? And also then, and I'm also going to stress, again, just as we've heard from other folks at this meeting about physician burnout, It is in epidemic proportions right now. And that good leaders, effective leaders, actually can recognize it and intervene. And that's the way that we're going to attack physician burnout, is taking care of each other and ourselves, and not letting somebody else try to do it for us.
Well, so this is such an important topic. It's great also that the college is recording it, so it will be available online, and I know people are going to go looking for it after you've just given such a great introduction.
Right.
I would make an appeal that after you give a lecture on leadership to all of us, you go to Washington and do that next.
Well, you know, the ACG does spend time in Washington on Capitol Hill through the governors, and it's another outlet for the voice of gastroenterology to be heard on Capitol Hill.
Great. Let's talk about IBD.
Yes.
One of the other named lectureships at this meeting is actually the American Journal of Gastroenterology lecture, and this year the person who gave that lecture was Corey Siegel from Dartmouth-Hitchcock. He spoke a little bit about precision medicine, focusing on the patient and how much progress we've made or maybe not have made. And I wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about what the key messages were from Corey's lecture.
Sure. So Corey has been really instrumental in helping us understand all of the issues around not just knowing what medicines we have available, but how to use them and when to use them. And that precision medicine has to also do with individualization for the patient and making the patient the center of all the decisions that are made. And he shared a very interesting statistic about only 18% of patients with IBD are on a biologic. And we understand that biologics are not to be seen as aggressive therapy, but effective therapy to mitigate all of the complications that happen years or even decades down the road, and patients who end up in the OR because of fistulas, because of strictures, because of refractory disease, they lose their colons, and that it's really important that we educate both the providers and our patients about the need for appropriate effective therapy earlier in the course of their disease so that we can avoid the complications. And I think that that was a really powerful message, that there's so much fear about perceived side effects and adverse events. But what people don't realize is that uncontrolled, unmitigated inflammation is far worse, yeah. Right? And that part of that discussion needs to be the comfort of the provider to be able to put into context for that patient, because we know the patients go out and look at Dr. Google after their physician has said, oh, you need to be on a biologic, and not understanding, again, the context of a lifetime of this disease.
That's right. Well, he had a poster at this meeting, and they looked at claims data of prescribed medical therapies for Crohn's and colitis, and he showed that a very small percentage of patients were actually getting the therapies that have been proven to be the most effective. And so I think that was a really powerful message. One of the things that you very nicely brought up is doctors are often afraid of what we might call an error of commission, and they commit more often errors of omission.
Right.
So people are nervous about the potential side effects when, on the other hand, they're withholding therapies that might be effective otherwise.
Correct.
One way that we in the field have started to understand how we might mitigate some of this is to identify targets to try to treat to achieve them and to move through our therapies more rapidly.
Right.
Can you comment a little bit about how you're doing that in your own practice?
Well, sure. You know, so as someone who's been doing this now for almost two decades, we were hopeful that we could have mucosa look okay or less inflamed. But now we know that these therapies, when used appropriately, can actually heal the mucosa. And you've shown actually, too, that you can achieve histologic healing. So those are the kinds of targets that we should be not just aiming for, but expecting in our patients, because we know we can get there.
And telling patients to expect it as
exactly.
part of that discussion.
Exactly.
Right? Great. Now, because this was a meeting that was in conjunction with the World Congress of Gastro, I understand there were 87 other countries represented here, really quite a group of people to come together. It might have been very appropriate that one of the key abstracts presented was on the global changes in epidemiology of IBD. So what have we learned about that?
Right. So at the plenary session, yes, so the largest audience that we're going to see at this meeting, about 6,000 people or so in the room, amazing, that not surprisingly, that the incidence of inflammatory bowel disease is rising across the world. And where are those numbers rising? In the newly industrialized nations. And it's sobering to know that also the rates of hospitalization for IBD is quite high. And that just goes to show that it's something in our environment, whether it's the hygiene hypothesis, whether it's pollution of the earth, but, you know, that we are actually making things cleaner at the same time we're making things dirtier, that this can't all be genetics, this can't all be diet, and that we really are now just one world, and that we're seeing the globalization of these kinds of chronic autoimmune diseases.
It's pretty compelling when you see that story. Do you think the IBD that's happening now in China, for example, is the same as the IBD we're seeing in the United States?
And that's a really good question. And I think that's why these sorts of meetings where there's an international presence and communication and discussion amongst gastroenterologists is, hey, do you see... What does your Crohn's patient look like? In my own practice, what I've found is that there are certain ethnic groups that don't have the same response rates to white man or Caucasian therapies. And it may just be that we don't have enough data, but certainly there are probably variances at the genetic level, or even the microbiome level, more likely, that makes some of these therapies more appropriate than others. I mean, we know that the Japanese have been using apheresis in their ulcerative colitis patients, and it just doesn't seem to work in Caucasians. They use a lot of tacrolimus. We don't as much. So there are variations. And also, in these newly industrialized worlds, communities don't necessarily have all of the biologics that we have, and certainly the role of the biosimilars now that are less expensive, equally effective, that we're going to be seeing the variations across the globe, but that there probably are variations to how patients respond.
So response to therapy, very important, as well as access, which you bring up with the cost of some of these therapies around the world. And certainly we're hopeful to see effective therapy available for whoever needs it, wherever they are. And our colleagues in other parts of the world are struggling to learn how to manage their patients and how to do this for the first time.
Exactly. And you know, you in our journals, we're seeing more and more sort of studies to look at how do you tell TB from IBD. It used to be that nobody had IBD in China or Korea. But now, it was always TB. But with work like this that's being shown that this is inflammatory bowel disease, I think it's a really important message that people need to hear.
Great. Perhaps similar to this concept of global or epidemiologic changes is the rise of Clostridium difficile in some parts of the world, certainly in North America and parts of Europe. We're recognizing that people with inflammatory bowel disease can develop pathogenic C. diff, even without an obvious exposure to antibiotics, which was always historically what people thought about. What did we learn about C. diff and IBD at this meeting?
Well, it's interesting. You know, one of the big clinical dilemmas is a patient who has active disease and you check C. diff and it's positive. And so should you be treating the C. diff and their underlying IBD as a flare, or is it enough to be treating the inciting episode, which is the C. diff? And so there was data at this meeting to suggest that if you escalated therapy to treat the active disease, that you were not increasing the risk for adverse events. So it's still going to be probably an individualized type of thought process here, but that particularly those patients who are mostly outpatients who are flaring and they're found to have C. diff, that if you escalate their therapy in conjunction with treatment of C. diff, that they're not going to have worse outcomes and that maybe that's a good idea. Perhaps those who are really sick who have complicated C. diff who are hospitalized, that it may just be enough to treat their C. diff and manage them conservatively and not push more immunosuppression in somebody who is critically ill.
Right. Well, clinicians are always asking themselves, is my patient who's flaring due to the C. diff, or is it due to their IBD and the C. diff is just an innocent bystander?
Right.
So you're an expert. How do you distinguish between those?
I think it's that you have to look over an amount of time, not just the cross-section if they are C. diff positive, that you're going to treat, that endoscopy is going to help you here, and that folks who don't get better after a course of either vancomycin or metronidazole, I personally use vancomycin, I've abandoned metronidazole altogether, that I really haven't found that many who are colonized with C. difficile, that they do fine, and then they get sick again, and then we treat them, and then they end up with FMT.
I do something similar. I use vanco as my preferred therapy, and I use the response to vancomycin almost as a diagnostic test,
sure,
as
right,
much as
right,
therapeutic.
Exactly.
And if they respond to the vanco, I suspect that at least part of what's going on is due to that Clostridium difficile.
Right.
Exactly the same. Well, this has been an incredible meeting. There's been a lot that we've learned and a lot more to look forward to. In your new role as president-elect, what will your responsibilities be and what should the folks out there know about?
Well, I think that the strengths of the college continue to be supporting the clinical aspects of gastroenterology and the clinician. So that means support with research funding, with advocacy, and with education. And I think the ACG speaks to all three of those very highly, and that with the funding for research that is then brought and shared at this kind of meeting, that we advance our patient care and the management.
Well, and I think anyone who's been at the meeting and anyone who's listening to what you have to say knows that they're doing a great job achieving those goals. So thank you for joining me.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
I'm Dr. David Rubin, and joining me for Best of the Day from the American College of Gastroenterology meeting, along with the World Congress of Gastroenterology, is Dr. Susie Kane from the Mayo Clinic.